Tibet, the roof of the world. It feels as though we have ascended a medieval stone fortress towering above the center of Asia. This is the highest country on Earth, and the most isolated.
When Brad Pitt made 7 years in Tibet, he, like Richard Gere and Steven Seagal before him, did what Westerners have always done. He fell in love with all things Tibetan. 150 years ago, explorers dreamed of traveling there. Today, the fascination continues, and the Dalai Lama is as big a celebrity as some rock stars. Journalist Orville Schell writes about this Western romance with a mountain kingdom in his book Virtual Tibet. Schell knows all about the lure of Tibet. As a kid, he too caught the bug.
When I was a boy, back in 1953, when 7 Years in Tibet first came out, this wonderful adventure story by Heinrich Harr and the story of his odyssey over the Himalayas from a British prisoner of war camp to Lhasa, where he became the tutor of the Dalai Lama, really did inoculate me, I think, with a sense that, you know, insofar as the world still had forbidden, mysterious, discrete places, this was one of them. And then it kind of lay latent. Subsequently, I got very interested in China and have written a lot about it. And then it was actually through my interest in China that I ultimately kind of revived this fascination with Tibet and went there early on in 1981 when it first opened and began to kind of wonder, you know, what was it about this place that so enthralled us?
Now, I suppose as a boy, what appealed to you must have been the adventure rather than any notion of the spiritualism of Tibet.
Yes, I mean, I think the spiritual aspect sort of manifested themselves as the mysteriousness of the ritual, the color, the chanting monks, and that this place was not only unabsorbable, it did not want to be absorbed. It did not want to have any truck at all with the sort of mundane, industrialized world outside. And that is a very beguiling notion, I think, to some young person.
Now, of course, the fascination with Tibet is not something new to you. I suppose it must have felt that way when you first read Heinrich Harrer's book. But a lot of Westerners for a long time have found Tibet to be, I don't know, some dream that they ought to pursue. What is it about the place that makes it so appealing?
Well, I think it's a combination of, I mean, I think it's a kind of a human impulse to want to believe that there are still some unexplored, mysterious nooks and crannies in the world. And at the end of the 19th century, of course, that was the great era of exploration and colonization. And, you know, whether they were leading trips to the North Pole, the South Pole, you know, Sir Francis Burton went to Mecca in the 1850s, the Amazon, all of these places were in the darkest Africa, Stanley. But Tibet was the most resistant of all. It had a real civilization, a real culture. It had this personification of all of this in the form of the Dalai Lama, this strange god king. There was all sorts of talk about the occult and magic practices, supernatural powers, and it was the stuff from which fantasies are easily woven.
One of the things that's so appealing about the idea of Tibet, I guess, is that it is geographically, literally, isolated from the rest of the world. Is it difficult even now to get there?
Well, now, of course, China has opened it up, and its only sort of realistically marketable industry is tourism. And so it's not so hard to get to. In fact, it's rather bizarre. I mean, when I was last there, I flew out from Lhasa to Nepal. And here I was flying in an hour, sipping a nice hot cup of coffee in a jet plane, you know, going over Mount Everest and traversing the very territory that it had taken Heinrich Harr 2 years on foot to traverse. Back in the time when there were no roads, there was not a single-wheeled vehicle in all of Tibet. There was no amenities. There was basically no modern affectations at all.
I think this may bring us to the title of your book, which is Virtual Tibet. The virtual Tibet is the one that actually appeals to most of us, isn't it?
Yes, and, you know, there are two different places. One is the real Tibet, which is a very harsh, remote, but beautiful in its stark way, and a very isolated land. And the other, of course, is the Tibet that we have fabricated, in a sense, out of much reality, out of all of the tales and the tales of incomplete adventure of people who never got to Lhasa, and we have imbued it with this special kind of redolence, not the least of which comes from things like James Hilton's 1933 novel Lost Horizon, and then Frank Capra's 1937 film, which did enshrine for all time this marvelous utopian dream of Shangri-La.
Well, let's talk about some of the reality before we get into those yearnings then. As we seem to think there is from the outside, is there a national Tibetan religion that everybody accepts?
Yes, and I think there's no society in the modern world that is still so devoted and so uniformly committed to one religion, namely Tibetan Buddhism, a form of Buddhism which came up from India before Buddhism vanished there and took root in 7th, 8th century in Tibet. And the fervor and the dedication with which Tibetans embrace their religion is indeed touching. And I think when you see nomads who have prostrated themselves inchworm fashion hundreds of miles all the way to Lhasa to reach the Jokhang, the most sacred shrine of Tibetan Buddhism, it harkens back to almost a medieval feeling that probably the last time we in Europe embraced that kind of commitment and dedication and awe, even perhaps fear in the case of Christianity, before our gods. And I think, you know, we miss that ability to consecrate ourselves wholeheartedly to something beyond ourselves.
One of the other things that makes the appeal of Tibetan Buddhism in the West so strong has been, over the last 50 years or so, the lack of recognition that it's received, the attack on its basic faith that has come from the Chinese occupation of Tibet.
One would have to acknowledge that the Chinese occupation, which is extremely brutal, has desecrated much of Tibetan culture and religion, but it still has not undermined the fundamental urge of Tibetans to be religious, to be Buddhist, and certainly has not impaired their extraordinary veneration of the Dalai Lama, even though you cannot put pictures of him up in Tibet now, and he is considered to be a splittist, even an insect. I mean, he's pilloried by the Chinese. And it's interesting because the Chinese have their own form of virtual Tibet. When they look up there, they don't see, you know, exoticism, romance, beautiful pageantry, spiritualism. They see feudalism, superstition, exploitation of, you know, serfs by aristocrats and the theocrats and the monastic system. They saw a very different picture. And their form of virtual Tibet is just sort of the utter contradiction to our version. And in some sense, I think the standoff of the quote, Tibet question centers around these two very reified and very sort of deeply held and deeply felt visions of this curious place.
Orville Schell is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is Virtual Tibet.